What has Ted Nugent done all his life with rock and roll? He has been totally uninhibited and had a great time, and nobody has gotten hurt. And more importantly, of the thousands of letters that I get, I have impressed upon young people and all different types of people that Ted Nugent has kicked more rock and roll ass than a whole herd of other people, and I've never gotten high. The rest of the record companies of the world went, oh, Ted Nugent sold 15 million records in 5 years? Did I miss something here? Yeah. This is Ted Nugent, and we are in the studio.
I asked Nugent how he had sustained such a loyal following now for over four decades.
Energy. Energy, authenticity. Cliff Davies on drums, God rest his soul. You know, we lost Cliff. Yeah. I'm always surrounded by the world's best. God must love me more than he loves you. He just keeps sending the masters. For example, the interviewers that I'm privileged to have a communication with. But Derek St. Holmes on soul vocals beyond Aretha Franklin. And a guitar player extraordinaire that was never given his just due. Rob DeLagrange on the bass guitar. These guys, Cliff, Derek, and Rob, are quintessential gifted rhythm and blues artists. Yes, we play uppity, borderline Caucasian, high-energy rock and roll, but they come from the Funk Brother altar. They come from the James Brown camp, the Wilson Pickett camp, a direct link to Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters via Bo Diddley, God rest his soul, and Chuck Berry. So we have more spiritual red wine fire pit communications than we do actually playing music. To remind each other as we get back into the belly of the beast of our music continues to reek off the tracks is believability. It's not the cleanest, most in-tune recording of all times, which is its beauty. It's raw. It's a primal scream. It's defiant. It's irreverent. It's the reason Les Paul electrified the damn guitar. And it's the reason Chuck Berry created those rhythms and why Bo Diddley blew up on that. That is, I'm sure that someone in the year 8 played that rhythm on a stretched skin in a cave somewhere. I mean, wouldn't you just grab a bone off of the femur of a recently harvested herbivore? Even in my African safaris to this very day, the tribal rhythms around the fires in those villages in Africa, it's a Bo Diddley thing. Look at the goosebumps, Redbeard. No. It's a Bo Diddley thing. So what you just identified is it ain't clean. It ain't pretty. It ain't in tune. And it didn't fit any formula. We made a point of that because formulas are shot on sight before they get anywhere near the perimeter.
Far and in between, I don't need no fancy jobs, I need the one.
a million seller in 76 without any radio play. I basically shoved guitar rock and roll down the throat of American radio.
And I said, hey,
listen, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, this is what the rock and roll people are digging. If you pass it up, you're a chump. Now, on the other side of the coin, Redbeard, let me tell you, there was a groundswell of support at radio that wanted to play my music so bad. There were certain program directors and there were certain powers to be that resisted, but they had to give in because Ted Nugent's street rock and roll was just a bit too powerful for them to resist any longer. And the disc jockeys that believed in me were my cohorts, and the music made its own statement, and those that believed in it jumped on it. And I really owe a serious debt of gratitude to the radio people who fought the resistance and supported me like they did. And that's why it's sold almost 3 million copies today. We recorded the Ted Nugent album in late 74 in Atlanta. We had a great team of believers who could envision controlling my stack of amplifiers in the studios and getting me to turn down a little bit so there was a microphone on the planet that could contain what I was doing, because I was one loud mofo, man. I mean, I just couldn't get enough of that stuff. And we went in, and without any alteration to the music really whatsoever, Derek sang his ass off with the soul that only Derek St. Holmes can sing with. And I played my guitar with all that live spirit that I was used to on an every night basis. And Rob DeLagrange thumped a rhythm bass guitar that was of the Motown essence. And Cliff Davies focused on the songs and the groove of the songs that I had written. And it was flagrant R&B. Stranglehold is just pure black. Hey Baby is just pure rhythm and blues, man. Chuck Berry and Little Richard wish they'd have written that song, and that's a Derek St. Holmes composition, and I'm very, very proud of that recording.
Tell us me by the clam and I'll baby. get higher, and sometimes you gotta start low. Some people think they're gonna die someday. I got news, you never got to go.
I was a major fan of Jimmy McCarty, the guitar player for Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels. He played a Birdland and had an unbelievable sound. Listen to the guitar solo on Jenny Take a Ride, even though I think that was a Gretsch Country Gentleman. It was a hollow body. And then on Good Golly Miss Molly and
Devil with the Blue Dress.
Devil with the Blue Dress and Sock It to Me. Those were Birdlands. And man, what a sound. There is a depth and a resonance, a timbre to the hollow body amplified guitar sound that you just couldn't get in those days from what I called surfboard guitars, the solid body guitars.
Yeah.
And also, we're learning to play louder and louder all the time. Well, the inherent characteristics of a hollow body instrument are resonant feedback through the amplifier, especially if you turn up like I started. And I started stacking amplifiers and widening them and multiplying them and breeding them, and I had more damn amplifiers than the white boy had a right to. And I love the way that Birdland howled. It's a super light instrument, which probably assisted my mobility on stage and let me go wild, but also it taught me to utilize a sonic element of feedback that most guys would settle for sustain. I mean, sustain lasts a long while, and the blues masters utilized it well, but I wanted more. I wanted to hang on to a note and juice and milk that sucker. And I learned to control the feedback instead of letting it overwhelm the sound.
Ted Nugent returns for his second multi-million seller in a row, plus the offer to headline the biggest concert in history for the staggering sum of $1 million for one show. But getting there almost cost Ted his life. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and visit us for a lot more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Turn 'Em Up Ted Nugent.
Yeah, this is Ted Nugent, and we are in the studio, and it is a free-for-all.
Thank you, Theodore. I'm Redbeard. Ted Nugent wasted no time to record and release Free-for-All in 1976.
Free-for-All is like the essence of a live show. I mean, I look them right in the eyes. Never before have I turned on you. You look too good to me. And that means, man, never before, never again, or ever in the future will Ted Nugent not be Ted Nugent. I'm looking you people in the eye every night on the road, and if you want this stuff, you go to a Ted Nugent concert, this is what you get.
You look too good to be true out there.
Give me those opening lines again.
Never before have I turned on you. You look too good to me.
There's a rap song in there.
Your beady eyes, they can cut me in two, and I just can't let you be. It's a free-for-all, and I heard it said, you can bet your life the stakes be high, and so be I. It's in the air tonight, yeah, yeah. Slag on, gone, gone, so like, ah, ah.
Never before have I turned on you. You look too good to me. Your beady eyes, they can cut me in two, and I just can't let you be. But it's a free-for-all, and a heart is dead. You can bet your life. Stakes are high, and so am I. It's in the air tonight.
Tyrannosaurus Ted with the title song to another multi-million seller, Free For All, in 1976. 2 years later, Ted Nugent was offered the headline slot for what was, at that time, the largest rock concert in history, California Jam 2. The promoters, which included late Apple computer founder Steve Jobs, offered Ted Nugent $1 million for one show. But no one, not even Ted, could have imagined the saga across two continents about to unfold.
March 18th, 1978. I'm in the Sudan. Friction between me and my wonderful wife, Mrs. Nugent, Sandra Nugent. She was supposed to go with me. It was a time of friction. We got married too young. She decided not to go to Africa with me. I said, I'm not going to Africa. She made it a point. Yes, you are. I want you out of here. So for her, I went solo. It was a dream. I'd never been to Africa. I took my bow and arrow, and I ran with the Maasai and the Watusi in the Sudan. And then civil war broke out while I was there,
whoa,
both at home and in the Sudan.
Okay.
And the Idi Amins of the Sudan began killing all the whites.
Oh.
They took over the Khartoum airport and killed everybody, white and black. It was a very dangerous time. The rainy season came early. It was now around March, I'm going to say March 14, and now we are driven out of the hunting area by the Civil War literally running for our lives. The Maasai guided us away from the travel of the guerrillas randomly killing people. Again, both natives and any whites were there. I had killed my first Cape buffalo with the bow and arrow, a spiritual moment. Wow. I had killed many African game with my bow and arrow and my rifle. It was a hunter's dream come true. So I had this peak of joy and celebration colliding with the fear of being killed by insurgents. The Maasai got me to Juba. I had to leave my bows, my guns, my trophies, all my belongings. All I had was a little canvas travel bag, which I still own, with Maasai fighting jewelry, my lion's claws, my warthog tusks, and a toothbrush. I had not seen a bed or any meal other than game that we killed on the run for about 5 days, or a shower. We were down to our last bottled water. I had 3 cartridges left for my 7 mag and was able to shoot 3 Grant's gazelles for the last of us to eat. There was about 8 of us in the party. Without the Maasai, I can't remember which. I couldn't tell the difference between Maasai and the Watusi, but various tribes took me under their wing because they loved that I was killing big, dangerous game with bows and arrows. They thought that they were ready to make me king. Mm. I could have stayed there, I suppose.
Yeah.
But they got me to Juba. There were no aircraft taking off because of the fear of being shot down. There was a Red Cross plane taxiing on a strip of sand in Juba, Sudan. I ran to it. 78, what was I? I was just 30 years old. I wasn't 30, I was 29 years old. And I impressed upon the pilot of that Red Cross plane, shall we say, that he was taking me someplace. And I got him in the air through threat of physical violence and the fact that the very tall blacks with spears backed me up. We took off and we landed in Cairo. I didn't know anything about Cairo. I didn't know what Cairo was, where Cairo was. I didn't know what to do. All I know is I had a wallet and a toothbrush with an American Express in my pocket. Made my way to an African Airlines. Nobody spoke English. I couldn't find an English speaker. I knew I had to be in Ontario, California. And the clock's ticking. And that's 6 hours later where I am. I'm trying to...
Kind of a big gig coming up.
$1 million for an hour on stage. Got on a plane. I figured out how to get on a jet from Cairo to London. I got blood on my feet. I haven't seen a shower. Got to London, looking a shambles, but people recognized me at London, and I ran. I saw on the screen, I had some guy show me how to use the phone at Heathrow, and I saw Concorde jet, Heathrow, Kennedy, New York City. I ran. I got security guys chasing me down there.
I'll bet.
I'm running. I go, it's all right, it's all right. And one guy goes, I think that's Loud Man. They called me Loud Man in
Loud
London.
Man.
I got on the seat of that. I broke past the stewardess, and I got on a seat on the Concorde and strapped myself in and go, you can fight me if you want, or you can just take the American Express and just sell me the damn seat. They took plan B. When I landed at Kennedy, we stopped on the tarmac where a security vehicle, I got down the steps off the Concorde, went to a TWA flight that they had held and pissed off a lot of people.
Oh.
Burned a Motor City Madman. I'm a shambles. My hair's... I look like Richard Pryor on fire. And I get on the plane. I must be stinking at this point. I mean, African mud and the blood, and I'd gutted some animals, and I just washed my hand a little bit. I had the African jewelry and the teeth and the claws in my bag. Now we're flying to LAX. I fell asleep. We get there. We land on the tarmac, another vehicle waiting for me. On the tarmac at LAX, I get out, take me over a couple hundred yards, get in a helicopter, land backstage at California Jam, March 18th, 1978, 15 minutes before I'm supposed to go on stage in front of what they estimate between 300 and 500,000 people. My buddy Craig Colburn, he's still with me. Craig is out there. Craig, everybody's going, oh, what are we going to do? Craig said, just set up. Guys, tune up. He'll be here. But we don't know where he is. We haven't heard from him. He'll be here. Ted'll be here. Just get ready. All right, get ready. And I landed the helicopter 15 minutes, put on the clothes, splashed the water on my face, pushed my hair out of my face, put a headband on to keep my raggedy old hair out of my face, I still hadn't washed the African mud and blood off me yet. So I put on the white pants and suspenders, and I strapped on that coyote's tail on my butt, and I grabbed that bird. I had not touched a guitar for 30 days. So that's where this appreciation for life also erupts on a daily basis. Okay. Is that wild?
It is.
No wonder my guitar sounds like that.
That's right.
But I'm not done yet. Ready? The band informed me they were quitting after the show.
No.
And my attorney told me my wife had filed for divorce. Dog, that was, again, man, when you're on the road and when you're in every major population area in the urban warfare zones of the world every night, you got that friction factor, man, and you know that it is dog eat dog out there. Sabotage on the downtown streets, police cars overturn, can't do nothing to beat the heat, and if you don't, you'll get burned. You know, I mean, that's the 67 riots and all that conflict that constantly goes on, man, whether it's got headlines or it's just happening in a corner someplace. It's always going on. It did then, it does now, and it always will.
Still to come, Ted Nugent defends himself against critics who say his colorful onstage antics and controversial quotes recently have gone from outrageously funny to mean-spirited. Follow your favorite rockers at InTheStudio.net and follow In The Studio on Facebook. I'm Redbeard with the great Gonzo himself, Ted Nugent, in the studio.
This is Ted Nugent, full time, and we are in the studio for Cat Scratch Fever.
And I'm Redbeard. Ted Nugent has been performing live since garage bands in Chicago, then the Amboy Dukes, then solo since the mid-70s in Detroit, with only the Damn Yankees detour in the early 90s. Ted Nugent passed the unbelievable 6,000 concerts mark just a few years ago.
So when you really want to get the ultimate Ted, you really got to go live. You got to go live, and you got to taste the sweat. You got to feel that middle finger on fire. You got to rejoice that we are created as a defiant species who questions everything, and we're supposed to find the status quo and destroy it whenever we see it. And hence my poor battered Gibson Birdland. Charlie Bird and Hank Garland did not envision those noises coming out of this beautiful jazz instrument. God bless volume. God bless feedback. So thank you for that. And those audiences know Uncle Ted didn't consider what we wanted. Uncle Ted is doing what he feels, and it happens to be what we feel too.
Right.
Go, Uncle Ted.
When I don't know where
Completing Ted Nugent's multi-platinum trifecta was 1977's Cat Scratch Fever album. If you think that Nugent's recent spate of foot-in-mouth disease may stem from eating too much red meat, Theodore points out that his idea of fun has always been fueled by an overamped level of testosterone.
There's been so many things, man. I used to shoot pumpkins off the stage with a 12-gauge shotgun on Halloween gigs back in the 60s. I've shot flaming skulls off with bows and arrows. I've had wild boar heads mounted on stage. I've had giant turkey vultures mounted on stage, you know. And we rock out, and when it's time to rock out, you can step over the border, and it's okay. You're supposed to get wild. I think the important part here is, what has Ted Nugent done all his life with rock and roll? He has been totally uninhibited and had a great time, and nobody has gotten hurt. And more importantly, of the thousands of letters that I get, I have impressed upon young people and all different types of people that Ted Nugent has kicked more rock and roll ass than a whole herd of other people, and I've never gotten high. I've never touched a drug. I've never drank alcohol, and I've never smoked a cigarette. I have rocked out with a good, clean spirit. And yeah, I might go over the borderline of some of the more conservative folks in the world.
But you're organic.
But I'm organic as hell, Captain. And if you want to have fun, call me. If you don't, you better step aside, Clyde.
Live It Up appears on the multi-million seller Cat Scratch Fever from 1977.
I'm a big fan of honesty. I'm a big boy. And you know,
that's
everybody I know is a big boy.
I've always been a fan of yours.
And I love everyone, but I'm the first one to tell them they got a booger coming out of their nose or that their zipper's down. You know, and I'm not your enemy for don't beat me up. I'm your friend. So bottom line is, when you step into the Nugent Ranch or the Nugent Band or just the Uncle Ted campfire, wherever you may find it, you fit right in because you have an alarm clock. You are a productive member in the asset column of this great experiment, self-government, and you deserve me. And I would cook up a backstrap for you any old time you wish. And that is the average, positive, high energy, caring, conscientious, fun person that you find in my band, in my business, in my hunting camps, and certainly in the Nugent family. And that's why I can't wipe this damn grin off my face. And then once I pick up the guitar, it grins too. And then everybody within 100 miles of me, it's so beautiful, I can hardly stand myself. Has anything changed? Nothing, just my underwear.
Thank God, too.
And I do every day. That's exactly why I thank every day. I'm a lucky, lucky man. You're looking at a happy, happy, lucky, lucky, ultra-alive man, even more so than that little whippersnapper son of a bitch that you interviewed 105 years ago. So I do. I get on bended knee and thank God every day. And once again, host the heroes, the wounded warriors, the salute to the heroes, the men and women of the United States military who have sacrificed so I can be this happy. So that's why my uppityness does not gently weep. My uppityness just increases its uppityness every day in appreciation for the American dream that those heroes have provided. That's why I'm like this red beard, and there's nothing can deter me.
I want to.
I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking Ted Nugent for allowing me to be his guest at his Texas ranch. Special thanks to my engineer, my brother Rob. In the Studio is written and produced by Redbeard for Bearded Fish Productions.